Hello and welcome to Gascast. In a Y chromosome heavy podcast, we're introducing our new binary outcome approach to research review, where you can look forward to us classifying surgery, Volivan, remifentanil, helicopters and Poland as either good or bad. Helping me to analyse the data, bring you the news, reviews, rants and more are Mark Salmon.
Hello.
Frank Schneider.
Hello.
And new voice, Sibtain Anwar.
Hello everyone.
So if you're wondering why the dulcet tones of Rebecca Smith are missing from this podcast, it's not that she's been sacked or has failed to get her computer started. It's just that unfortunately, due to holidays and time zone differences, we weren't able to find a slot when we could all meet up online. But we're very excited to be joined by Sibs, who'll be standing in for Bex on this episode. Sibs, do you want to do a little introduction?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, sure. So I'm a specialist registrar in anaesthetics in London, much like the rest of the gang. But at the moment, I'm hiding away. I'm out of program doing research, and I've been doing that for the last almost 3 years now. So it's good to come back and talk about anaesthetics, even if I don't practice every day.
Good to have you here.
Thanks.
Did a little Graham from Blind Date style quick reminder about you. Do you want to hear it?
Okay.
All right. Here we go.
Okay. I've got to hear this.
Fun-loving Capricorn, Sibs, hails from the Central School of Anesthesia in London, but currently works in the Pain and Anesthesia Research Centre at St Bartholomew's Hospital. Sibs's research interests include chronic pain, cardiothoracic anesthesia, and complex retrospective data analysis. When he's not hard at work tidying his desk, Sibs enjoys alcohol, walking his cat spot, and pre-medicating his patients with pregabalin and ketamine.
Excellent.
I thought that was quite good.
Thanks very much.
But anyway, Sibs, welcome to Gascast. And as you know, we always start with our Discovery of the Month section. So as the new boy, would you like to go ahead with what you're going to wow us with this month?
Brilliant. Thanks very much. Well, I've got two Discoveries of the Month. The first one will interest everyone. And I'm hoping to persuade all of you to take an interest in the second. So the first one is, it's a new device, an invention. There's a Cambridge company. They're bringing onto the market the first commercially available point-of-care device for measuring blood concentrations, plasma concentrations, that is, of propofol. So the argument is that this is akin to end-tidal anesthetic agent measurements, and they're suggesting one day the routine use of this device, especially in the intensive care unit after long periods of sedation, but also really their hope is to bring this to the market as a device for use in theatre. So the end of a long cardiac case or any long theatre case where your patient's not waking up and you want to exclude the fact that you just haven't waited long enough. The device itself, it's similar to a sort of a TEG device or other point-of-care devices. You put in a small sample, 0.7 mils of blood. You wait 5 minutes and you get a result. It gives you a concentration from 0 to 20 micrograms per mil of propofol. And then that's as useful as it possibly can be. I mean, it's not target site concentration, it's blood concentration. But the idea is that over time, you gain experience with levels and they're able to determine whether or not the patient's asleep because of propofol or something else has happened. So that's their idea. And it's the first time I've heard of it. And I don't know if you guys have heard of it before.
No, I haven't heard of it. And I'm struggling to think of many times when I think I would have found that really useful. But I guess time will tell.
Yeah, no.
Comes up frequently, doesn't it, that you want to know what the blood level of concentration was 5 minutes ago.
This is what I'm thinking.
Or any point in the theatre case, or even in the future, to be honest. I agree, the utility of it is fairly limited. Their argument is in intensive care, you know, but even in intensive care, I can't imagine a scenario where this would be useful.
Right, because the end point is what you see in front of you, especially in ITU. If somebody's not, you know, tolerating their tube or their blood pressure is too low or whatever, that's how you titrate. The numbers truly are arbitrary.
They are. I mean, they would be useful in a research setting, and these devices have been used in research, and I think they're trying to make that translation from there to a real market, and I think that might be a leap of faith.
This is the Marsh model that a lot of the PK3 pumps use. It'll be interesting to see how that actually marries up.
Yeah, it'll be really interesting to see.
Target site concentration.
Because that is kind of a magic number that's based around not a lot of patients. I mean not a lot of data that you're putting into the patient.
This is exactly their argument. Their argument is that anaesthetists rely on a model which predicts it and they can give you a real value. But the argument fails because the target site, which we're interested in. They can't really measure. So these guys are pitching. They're in a very big teaching hospital not far from us at the moment, tonight, pitching this. And their argument is this will be coming to a theatre near you.
Well, what's interesting is that the technology can't be too far away to have continuous sort of inline measurements, which would then allow you to do more useful things like have sort of closed loop systems for maintenance of anesthesia and that kind of thing. Or not.
How do you mean too far away, sorry?
If you've got the technology to do point of care testing, and I don't know what the sort of physics of the testing is. But in the same way that you've got inline electrodes that can do sort of electrolyte and pH testing for bypass machines, for example, you could potentially have the same sort of system that would give you continuous propofol concentration measurements.
Which would be more useful, because that would be akin to end tidal.
Yeah.
In fact, that would be useful during cardiac bypass.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm sure it's a ways away, and I'm sure it's not that easy or straightforward to do, but clearly it's possible that this must be the sort of first step towards that kind of technology.
And this company makes inline measurements of other parameters, including blood glucose, mainly for research.
Yeah.
So I think that may well be the next step they take if this is a commercially viable option.
But out of interest, Sibs, do you have a price for it?
I don't. So even the website declares that this is not for sale, it's not for clinical use at the moment, and it explicitly states that it's a research tool. But it's interesting that they are out and about in the City of London, at least, trying to suggest the idea and sell the product.
Absolutely. Well, it's definitely an interesting idea, and we look forward to hearing about a clinical application for it, even if we're struggling to imagine one. And so what was your other one?
Well, my second discovery of the month is not really a discovery. It's more of an unashamed plug. It's a meeting that I'm helping to organise with some colleagues of mine from Imperial and UCL. It's a meeting for research trainees. We run a forum called Portal, which is Perioperative Research Forum for Trainees in London. And through our website, periopresearch.com, we're running our fifth annual meeting looking at future directions in perioperative research. So we've invited Professor Hines to come and speak about research in intensive care, as well as Dan Martin, who's a new intensive care consultant at the Royal Free, who'll be talking about the future, again, of perioperative research. And then Andrew Morley will be speaking about his exhibition at the Science Museum about public engagement of anaesthesia and the future prospects of that. And all of this is a free meeting that we're organising on the 23rd of November, an all-day meeting. I don't know if I mentioned that it's free. It's at the London Deanery, which, as you can imagine, in its palatial surroundings and with all the trimmings of free lunch, etc. And without using the word free again, I'd like to point out that everyone's invited, and we will be offering a £500 prize as well for the best abstract related to perioperative research. So feel free to log on to periopresearch.com and have a look and submit your abstracts as soon as you can.
Excellent. We love a free meeting, and that does sound like a great lineup of speakers, including, we normally like to refer to him as friend of the podcast, Andrew Morley.
Isn't the exhibition starting off, is that this month?
I think it is this month, actually. We had a couple of emails. We are definitely going to do a follow-up piece from that. So one of us will be going, I'm sure. And I think we might be organising an interview with some of the Science Museum curators who are helping to organise and host the exhibition. Good. Well, Sibs, thank you very much. That was an awesome start to the podcast.
Okay, thanks.
Frank, what do you got for follow-up?
Well, I feel like I've got slim pickings now, and this is not really particularly anaesthetic related, but I just thought quite interesting. And the only link back to anaesthesia is that it came up in discussion with one of our anaesthetic professors. And it really was about, and I don't know how aware all of you are of the anatomy of the greater mammals, but apparently greater mammals other than humans, that is, and birds, have all got a splenic capsule that has got muscle fibers in it, and can contract in response to a fright or flight sort of signal or during exercise, and increases their hematocrit by 30 to 40%. So the professor I was speaking to was obviously interested in knowing whether that was true in humans as well, and this research probably dates back to the 70s and 80s, and he put one of your and my old anaesthetic consultants onto an exercise bike, injected him with radioisotope-labeled red blood cells, and then put them through his paces to see if they could pick up any sort of auto-transfusion from splenic capsule contraction. And sadly, they couldn't, so there isn't. And it's of absolutely no use to us in... and actually, this whole discussion came along at the time of the Olympics, so, and we'd been discussing how useful it would be to be an Olympian and be able to increase your hematocrit by 30 to 40% every time you started exercising.
Mm. But he only did an N equals one study, so maybe he just got one of the few people who can't do it, and in fact, Olympians can.
Yeah.
Incredibly underpowered.
Yeah, incredibly. That's brilliant.
Mm. So, you obviously can't name the professor.
I don't think there's any conflict of interest. It's Prof Hall from George's, who teaches me something new every time I do a list with him. He's great fun.
That is some excellent batty science, though. just get one of your registrars and inject him with some radio-labeled... what was it? Radio-labeled what?
They collected a blood transfusion from him, then labeled his red cells with a radionuclide, and then retransfused it.
And then stuck him on an exercise bike.
Him on an exercise bike with a gamma camera.
That is brilliant. How long? I bet he got that organised. He probably had the idea in the morning and had the experiment organised by the afternoon.
Signed off by the non-existent.
Great example of IOI.
Yeah, love that. Love that. Sibs, why don't we have a gamma camera at work? We should buy one immediately.
I'm sure St. George's will lend us theirs.
it's
probably in Prof Hall's bottom drawer.
No, that is a pretty good discovery. I'm starting to get fearful because mine is looking progressively weaker as we carry on recording. Mark, what have you got?
Well, that all segues quite nicely into what I was going to mention. It's a bit different, but as we're talking about poorly conducted studies and wild-eyed scientists, I just wanted to talk about the new book out last week from Ben Goldacre. So as I'm sure you all know, Ben Goldacre is a semi-celebrity wild-haired doctor. He came to fame with his book Bad Science, which generally pointed out a lot of the misinformation in the modern media. But this new book is an all-out sting on the pharmaceutical industry. He says that drug companies, and these are his words, this book describes how drug companies harm patients around the world by distorting evidence on an industrialist scale. So he reckons that, there's some nasty stuff going on, and that academics, doctors and regulators are all kind of partially to blame for failing to do anything about it. But he says the crux of the problem is negative trials being suppressed and positive trials being tweaked, and journals and official teaching all being, or not all, but partially being in the pocket of industry. I haven't read all of the book yet, but it's pretty strong stuff and pretty interesting.
Mm. So his arguments are quite compelling. He argues that for every sort of one positive study, there have been seven negative ones buried for some of the biggest drugs that we use. And so his argument is that if you keep fishing long enough, you'll find the fish that you want. I think it's quite a powerful read.
Yeah. You can do a funnel plot, can't you? Is that what it's called? Where you look at the type of... if you're looking at a research question, I think if you do a funnel plot based on these published studies, you should be able to get a certain proportion of... is it positive or negative ones or something? But you can actually see how skewed the data set is, and that if there should be negative trials and whether or not they are present. That was badly explained.
That sounds a bit like the stuff with the stuff we talked about a few months ago with all of that Japanese guy's research. Isn't that how they...
No, that was actually something completely different. They
All right, just cut this whole conversation out then.
Don't get Rick started on it.
Just trying to be smart.
So was I. We're going to have to cut that or consult the internet. I don't know, I'm right. It is a funnel plot to look at publication. Publication bias. I think it's funnel plots you use and you look for evidence of publication bias. Anyway, I clearly don't know what I'm talking about, so why don't I just move on to my discovery instead? So mine, not as exciting, but I did get this through on a BMJ Careers email, and it caught my attention. because the number of female doctors may outnumber male doctors by 2017. The number of female doctors registered with the General Medical Council has exceeded the 100,000 mark for the first time, rising by 4.7%. Female doctors now account for 43% of the total, and the GMC estimates that it will overtake male doctors by 2017. The GMC also says that there is some evidence that working patterns are influencing career choices, with women currently underrepresented in specialties such as cardiology, gastroenterology, anaesthetics, and surgical specialties. Other interesting bits in this were that more than a third, 37% of doctors registered with the GMC, hold a non-UK primary medical qualification, which sounds extremely high.
Well, that's high, yeah.
The largest provider of foreign provider of doctors is India, followed by Pakistan, and then South Africa.
Well, a good 50% of the usual podcast team.
Yeah, so in fact, possibly not that surprising. Anyway, it occurred to me when I was looking over the material for this podcast that we're pretty much going to be giving everything a binary classification of either good or bad. Frank, you're going to be starting off this month by giving us the news on whether Voluven is good or bad, but before we start, I'd like to thank Bex, even though she's not here, for her help with some of the research for this episode.
You're assuming she's going to listen to this now that she's not on.
And that, to be honest, is a big leap. I happen to know that various people here on this podcast do not listen to it.
Hmm.
Mark.
No, I've never listened to one all the way through.
Don't say that in front of Rick.
I've had to listen to it once unedited, so it's quite enough.
Sorry, Frank.
I don't even listen when we're recording it.
I've
got the Great British Bake Off on in the background.
For the next 4 minutes and make another cup of tea.
Frank, so sorry. Listen, Voluven, good or bad?
Yeah, Rick, I'd hate to correct you there because I'm afraid you'll be incurring the wrath of Fresenius Kabi as well as the New England Journal of Medicine because they, in fact, got the formulation wrong. What they used in the study was Tetraspan, which is slightly different to Voluven in the sense that it's a slightly different component. But you're quite right, it's a hydroxyethyl starch. And the article from the New England Journal of Medicine was looking at the use of hydroxyethyl starch, and this was the 130 kilodalton 0.42 as opposed to Ringer's in severe sepsis. Now, for those of you who do want to switch off after this, I'll just tell you that the sort of take-home message, and this was a multi-center international study over a number of ICUs in Scandinavia, and randomly assigned patients in normally defined sepsis were given either 6% hydroxyethyl starch or Ringer's for resuscitation to the same sort of volumes. And the results from both groups, and I think there were about 804 patients who were randomized, around 800 that were in the intention to treat population, and about 400 in each group. And essentially, at 90 days after randomization, one of the primary endpoints was death, and 51% of those patients receiving Hess had died, as opposed to 43% of those receiving Ringer's, and the relative risk there was 1.17. And one of the other endpoints they'd looked at were need for renal replacement therapy, or in fact, renal replacement therapy at 90 days. And again, those patients who'd received Hess had higher requirement for renal replacement as opposed to Ringer's. So the conclusion from that was that severe sepsis, who were assigned fluid resuscitation with Hess, had an increased risk of death at 90 days and were more likely to require renal replacement. So to go through a bit more detail of that, and I won't spend too much time on it, but we've been speaking about dodgy research, and of course you can't talk about starch, colloids, and replacement without mentioning one of our other favourite rogues in the anaesthetic rogues gallery, and Joachim Bolt's research on the retractions. And obviously he's done a lot of, or had published a lot of articles which are now of dubious value in the use of colloids, especially in cardiac and cardiac surgery environment. So on the back of that, and the fact that in the institution I'm currently working in, we've had a number of anaphylactic reactions to colloids, and it does seem that looking at literature in general, people are a bit more hesitant about giving colloids and really questioning again the benefit of giving colloid over crystalloid, which seems to be a safer option. So this study was the Scandinavian Starch for Severe Sepsis Septic Shock, or 6S trial, and really looking at the effects of Hess in this which was what was supposed to be a safer formulation. If you remember that older starch formulations had higher molecules and higher substitution ratios, so 200 kilodaltons. And those were shown or thought to have increased incidence of problems with renal failure and bleeding and so on. But there wasn't conclusive research with regards to the newer formulations. And Rick, as you mentioned, Tetraspan is the same as Voluvin. I don't know if anyone has Tetraspan in their hospitals. Mostly places I've worked at, I've come across Voluvin and Volulite, which are the sort of equivalent preparations, if you like. The trial was run from the end of December in 2009 through to mid-November in 2011, and was based in Denmark, Norway, Finland, and Iceland, and they had patients from 26 general intensive care units. And it seems to be pretty well set up. I won't go through the details, but it was multicenter and blinded, with centralized randomization. The trial fluid was delivered in identical bags that were in custom sort of black bags, so that people actually treating weren't able to see whether they were giving Ringer's or colloid. And if you look at the rest of the breakdown of the trial, again, I won't go through all the exclusions, but essentially they ended up with 400 patients who were assigned starch and 400 were assigned Ringer's laxase. And the idea was that they would get 33 mils per kilogram of ideal body weight, and the intention of that was to try and make sure that they were well within the recommended dose for starch solutions given by the manufacturers. As I said, the primary outcome was death or dependence on dialysis in 90 days after randomization. And then they looked at a number of secondary outcomes as well, many of which didn't reach significance, and I'll just mention briefly the ones that are of interest. Baseline characteristics across both groups were very similar. And just of interest to note in the characteristics that they list in the table is that obviously a large percentage of the population in both groups had established shock, if you like, about 84% in each arm, and between 35 and 36% already had acute kidney injury. And that, again, was defined by SOFA score and plasma creatinine levels or decreased urine output. What was interesting as well from this is that both groups actually only received a median cumulative volume of 3 litres. So it didn't seem that that there was a huge difference in the volume required for resuscitation, which is one of the sort of historic arguments for colloids being better in terms of maintaining intravascular volume. Also, as you'd perhaps expect, more patients in the starch group receive blood products. And going back to the incidence of acute kidney injury, they did actually look at these groups specifically later on to see that there was no difference in those patients who had established renal injury in either group. So there was no difference whether they had pre-existing renal impairment or not. So what's come through in the discussion is that there does seem to be a significant increase in the absolute risk of death, and that at 90 days, and that's by 8%, which translates to a number needed to harm of 13. And this is really in keeping with some other studies which weren't quite as adequately powered as this. But I think it does give us cause to pause and think about what we're using for resuscitation fluids, and obviously this is in quite a specific setting, so established sepsis in ITU patients. And I think that may just guide further investigation into this area, and unfortunately add fuel to the whole colloid versus crystalloid debate.
So it was really quite a damning paper for heterostarches. As you say, it's very much focused on patients with severe sepsis, and people are going to be very, very tempted to extrapolate that to the other uses of heterostarch.
I think it's such a large study, and these studies are so hard to conduct, and therefore it probably won't be done with other heterostarches, and it probably will be the nail in the coffin heterostarches. It's difficult to imagine someone going ahead and repeating it in a slightly different way. I think a study with 800 patients, 400 in each arm, may well be the study that changes practice in this.
It would almost be ethically difficult to do, wouldn't it, after this result?
Absolutely. Yeah, I suppose the only issue is how it translates to other patient groups. But you're right. I mean, I think people it's going to be difficult to get these sorts of things approved. The researchers were obviously aware of some of the limitations. They looked specifically at those patients who had acute kidney injury at the time, because I think that would have otherwise been a criticism. And both those groups showed similar results in subset analysis. So yeah, I mean, I think it does seem to give quite good evidence for it. And that's really translated into, well, at least anecdotally in our hospital, people being a lot more hesitant to give colloids overall, but obviously specifically in patients who present with sepsis or renal impairment.
I quite like HETA starches, or I did quite like HETA starches, but I certainly would think more than twice and probably not give them now. The increased incidence of blood products was very interesting. I didn't really I didn't look at it carefully enough, but what was the thinking behind that?
Well, I think let me just find that.
My only thought was there was an increased use of blood products, wasn't there, in the HETA starch group. And we know that increased use of blood products for a number of reasons is associated with a worse outcome. So I wonder if they'd reconciled that and they'd seen if it was directly due to the blood products or was in fact due to the HETA starch as a factor on its own.
Yeah, I don't... I'm just scanning through it again, but I don't think they did look at that. When I was reading, I just assume that the difference was, as we know, I mean, some of these starch solutions can cause problems with bleeding or prolongation of clotting times and so on, and whether they were then more likely to receive blood and blood products. So it says in the starch group, 38 patients at 10% had severe bleeding compared with 25 or 6% in the Ringer's group, but confidence interval is quite wide and crosses 1, and it wasn't. Table 3 wasn't significant or statistically significant.
Well, thank you for that, Frank. A very thought-provoking paper. Just remind me, what was the result of Bolt's work? Did it come out in favour of colloid use?
I mean, he did... most of his work was on specifically on the use of starch colloids and also, funnily enough, on cardiac output monitoring and sort of pulse wave analysis, that sort of thing. But yeah, he was very pro HETA. Oh, actually, I stand to be corrected. But as far as I can remember, he was very pro HETA starch. The only reason I say that is because he was always on the brochures that the drug companies gave out with their ads on starch colloids. So he must have been supporting them.
Good. So there you have it. If you've just woken up after yet another fascinating fluid debate, the headline news is that HETA starches are now bad. So moving on to other things that you may have thought were good but are in fact bad, Sibs, you're going to be telling us all about chronic pain in sternotomy patients and factors that can potentially precipitate it.
That's right. So thanks, Rick. So I'm presenting a paper from this month's BJA. And it's a Dutch group's work presenting data which puts the claim out there that remifentanil use intraoperatively during cardiac surgery may be linked in some way, correlated with chronic pain at a year post-op. So just before I go into the actual paper and the data itself, we all know that chronic post-surgical pain is becoming an increasingly sexy topic. Awareness is increasing, not just amongst us, but even surgeons are accepting that this may be a phenomenon. Patients are even becoming more aware of it, and family physicians often refer patients or are certainly aware of the whole concept. There's very little data out there, so any study, whether it's retrospective or prospective, adds to that body of knowledge. But most of us will be interested in this study because it's to do with remifentanil. It's a drug we all use in everyday practice, and the consequences of it, therefore, are fairly wide-reaching. So the paper itself, it's not a perfect paper. It's a follow-up analysis, or more properly, a secondary analysis of the original study which they carried out. So the original study these guys carried out was looking at procedural pain after cardiac surgery. So they assigned patients to a regime where they either received 2.5 milligrams of morphine or 7.5 milligrams of morphine for procedural pain. And they assessed whether or not that was, they assessed their pain scores after the procedure, whether or not there was, try to get an idea of whether or not they were appropriately treating them in the intensive care unit. The results are fairly vague about that study. I mean, they haven't commented on it in this paper. They don't reference that study itself. But what they've now done, and they seem to be more interested in, is 2 years after the event, they've re-examined the data looking for risk factors of chronic sternotomy pain. What they found initially was that having not protocolized the anesthetic, 58% of the patients had received remifentanil intraoperatively, and the others hadn't. And so what they've done is they've collected all the data, contacted the patients a year after the event, and taken the outcomes in terms of chronic pain and had a look back using a multivariate regression modeling system to see whether or not age, BMI, use of remifentanil, amongst other things, are important. What they have found, they've confirmed that young age is a risk factor for developing chronic post-surgical pain of any sort. They've also confirmed that an increased BMI increases the risk of either intraoperative nerve damage or other changes that may subsequently lead to chronic persistent pain after surgery. What they found most interesting, or which is a headline here with this paper, is that the use of remifentanil in those 58% of patients does correlate with pain at a year. So not only have they found a binary, as it were, association, they've also found a dose-dependent association. So patients over a certain threshold, there is a correlation between how much remifentanil was given, was infused intraoperatively, and the likelihood of having chronic pain at a year. So before I go on to discuss the methodology and sort of, you know, try and criticize this paper, the things that are in its favor is that they do demonstrate the patient demographics and the type of surgery and other details relating to the operation are identical in both groups, the remifentanil patients who received remifentanil and those that haven't. What they do, the criticisms are that, first of all, their incidence of chronic post-surgical pain is 20%, which is much lower than the normal quota of 35% for sternotomy. So that makes you wonder about that group they recruited into the study, the sort of patients that agreed to be in the research project, and indeed whether or not there was a selection bias as far as that's concerned. The other thing that stands out is that they had 8% mortality in their group, which is significantly higher than published data. So this is a secondary analysis of admittedly prospectively collected data. So therefore, it's superior to retrospective analysis where someone's gone out and collected data and gone fishing for associations. It's been regression analyzed. So it's not as advantageous as setting out a prospective trial where you've randomized patients and then blinded all involved. So obviously there are criticisms to the study, but if there is a signal here, it has huge implications. I wanted to mention opioid-induced hyperalgesia as a phenomenon in itself. We all know the definition hyperalgesia, which is increased response to stimulus that's normally painful. But opioid-induced hyperalgesia is a concept which is akin to opioid tolerance. So it's sort of described as almost as if it's an acute opioid intolerance. It's a phenomenon that's described with higher doses of opiate. So the idea is that beyond the effect of that opiate itself, the patient is exhibiting signs of hyperalgesia. So hours after remifentanil, for example, or alfentanil, the patient is still able to elicit signs of hyperalgesia. This has been shown in experimental animal models, but the clinical data sort of is in its infancy. And so a study like this does have some interest and utility from that point of view. The clinical studies that are out there, for example, in abdominal surgery, where the use of remifentanil at 0.1 versus 0.2 versus 0.3 mics per kilo per minute does show a significant increase in the amount of wound hyperalgesia, opiate use, beyond the action of the remifentanil itself, so in the postoperative period and for days up to 78 to 2 hours afterwards. Likewise, the thoracotomy data also shows that patients who have had remifentanil intraoperatively have wound allodynia hyperalgesia, increased zones of tenderness around that wound for up to 72 hours, well beyond the action of remifentanil. So it's a clinical phenomenon as well as an experimental theory. The reason it's particularly relevant here, of course, as I say, is because these guys have shown an association with chronic pain, and that's the first study to show the link to chronic pain, and that could potentially be important. So having mentioned all of this, I mean, it just reminded me also of the importance of of not drawing conclusions on retrospective or secondary data. And for example, the recent interest in regional anesthesia as a possible contributor or preventer of cancer recurrence. Likewise, retrospective studies, for example, in the paravertebral breast cancer population or the prostate cancer population, have shown that there may be a link between the use of these anesthetic techniques and cancer recurrence. And likewise here, there is a link between anesthetic technique and potential long-term morbidity and patient outcomes. But these are all retrospective studies or secondarily analyzed studies. And so, you know, without sounding like the broken record of research, we all await the prospective randomized controlled trial. The end.
Fantastic. Thank you very much. It's quite recent news to me about the hyperalgesia effect and remifentanil. You obviously know a lot more about this than the rest of us do. But how long has this actually kind of been a thing?
I don't know a huge amount to look at it, but also it seems that it is, as far as clinical evidence is concerned, it really is in its infancy. Animal models don't always translate well, especially in pain medicine and pain research. It seems that the clinical studies that I've described are the mainstay of the body of knowledge. The interesting thing here seems to be that the increased requirement for opioids in the postoperative period extends well beyond the action of these drugs. So clearly there's a phenomenon of either peripheral or indeed peripheral and central sensitization which takes place. We've always thought of the idea that neuropathic pain is a chronic phenomenon, and here's an idea that short-term pain can also be neuropathic, can sensitize, and can indeed cause hyperalgesia. And these drugs may be contributing to that. They may well be triggering a process which causes sensitivity, and this paper suggests may even cause long-term chronic pain.
So what I could ask to know, if you have you seen the other study that they got the data from?
I haven't, no. So it's incredibly hard to find that study, actually, because so that study is it's on clinicaltrials.gov, but the results haven't been published.
Yeah. Because I was just curious, because it seems, from what I understood, the both groups received similar amounts of fentanyl. I'm not too sure what the sort of thinking was behind who got Remy and who didn't.
It was completely arbitrary. So it was completely at the convenience of the anaesthetist.
Of the anaesthetist, yeah. But
it was basically down to poor trial design, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. So they didn't standardise the anaesthetic protocol.
That's not what they were looking at.
As they were looking at post-operative procedural pain analgesia requirements or use, rather, they were happy to let the anaesthetist and indeed the surgeons do exactly what they wanted to. In a better design study, they would have standardised all patients to receive remifentanil or none.
Yeah, you'd think that's going to be a problem, because the people who use remifentanil may all do several other things in common that
absolutely, or not do other things which the others have done.
It
almost goes without saying. So there are several faults to the secondary analysis. There are several faults to the original study, but if there is a signal, if there's any chance, it certainly warrants prospective study. Whether we get excited by this, we clearly shouldn't. But it's an opportunity to investigate a phenomenon which otherwise may not have reared its head for a while, if at all.
Well, it's definitely worth asking the question, because if it turns out that opiates are bad, then that's a total game changer.
Sure.
I think it's unlikely to be opiates in general, but it does look like it's specifically going to be remifentanil, doesn't it?
Well, there's some data that alfentanil also has a similar effect, but I'd be guessing or second guessing for saying whether it will just be remifentanil.
Well, it is interesting to think about what the mechanism is and whether it is more common, obviously remi, which is a sort of a quick on and off set, and alfentanil to a lesser extent, more so than other opioids, and whether it is related to the duration of action and the sort of pharmacokinetics of it.
There's a certain irony in an opioid which is meant to be quick onset and offset having the longest, the farthest reaching implications in terms of chronic pain.
Your chronic misery.
Yeah.
I know. Well, I love a Remy infusion. So I remember reading about hyperalgesia back when we were studying for exams. But yeah, it was certainly not well established. And as you say, Sebs, I don't think there were any good clinical studies. It was mostly animal models.
It was.
But yeah, it'll obviously change the sort of attraction of remifentanil infusions if it all does show that hyperalgesia and chronic pain, for that matter, are real problems.
I mean, this has, it is, as I, you're right, this does have potential consequences, huge potential consequences, but it's too early to say at this stage.
Remy's not off patent yet, is it?
I don't think so. Pass.
Should be, actually. Sadly, my solution of just giving people a big dose of morphine before discontinuing the Remy infusion is clearly not going to cut the mustard.
Well, this is some of the argument that the reason patients need so much morphine afterwards is not simply because you've stop the remifentanil and short-acting, but you also hyperalgese them. You've actually sensitized them. So some of the opiate is for operative surgical needs, but the rest of it is to treat the hyperalgesia-induced hyperalgesia.
Yeah. Very good.
So far, it's been a slightly negative podcast, and to continue that negative theme, Mark, it's about time that we slot in your monthly rant. How's that going?
Oh man, I don't even know if I can keep this one in under a minute. I haven't timed it, so...
Okay, well, you'd be pleased to know, in Bex's absence, I downloaded a new timing app onto my non-iPhone. All right, anyway, I'll count you in. So 3, 2, 1, go.
Well, in the last few short months, most of us have forgotten the warm collective glow of our much-hyped glorious Summer of Sport 2012. Some people close to me, however, people whose opinion I would normally trust, are persisting in donning their skimpy shorts and running, voluntarily, for fun. I mean, my wife and you, Rick. I, on the other hand, avoid running at all costs, except in situations where my life is in immediate danger. And even then I have a fairly low threshold for giving up, assuming the fetal position and awaiting my fate. Very rarely I will break into a canter for altruistic reasons, like emergencies in theatres, or last Sunday when I got an obstetric emergency call whilst attending an A&E priority call at the other end of the hospital. Imagine my dismay when I arrived on the third floor labour ward, wheezing like a 14-year-old asthmatic locked in Jimmy Savile's smoking room, only to be told that they wanted to do an instrumental delivery and there was no rush. This is my plea to everyone. There are almost no situations where a generic crash bleep is as useful as a normal bleep followed by a short conversation. If we know what we're going to be going to deal with, we've got a much better idea of who or what to bring with us. Please, think, and don't make me run again.
Excellent. Excellent. Very good. A little bit over.
That's very good.
Too soon for a Jimmy Savile gag?
I don't think so.
Strike while the iron's hot.
Well, thank you very much for that, Mark. We've been on a bit of a negative skew so far this podcast, so it's time for me to reverse that trend with some good anaesthetic research news. So for my article, I don't know if you guys remember or were involved in collecting data back in April 2011 for the USOF study. Anybody do any of that?
No.
No, we were asked to, but we never got around to it.
That reflects poorly on you as a research trainee.
So the results are out and were published in The Lancet at the end of last month and were very interesting. So for those of you not familiar with it, by way of introduction and background, we have fairly good outcome data for very specific sets of patients, such as those undergoing vascular, joint replacement or cardiac procedures. Whilst these studies give us useful data for these very specific populations, it doesn't help to inform us about the general surgical population which we, as anaesthetists, should be most interested in. The USOS, which stands for European Surgical Outcomes Study, aimed to address this by performing a pretty massive international cohort study, collecting data on all non-cardiac surgical patients for 1 week between the 4th and 11th of April 2011, and then following them up for 60 days. I believe the hope was to identify differences in mortality rates between countries and then use the data collected to try and identify modifiable features of the common care pathway that could be used to improve surgical outcomes. So as I said, the data was collected on all patients operated on in the participating centres, which included 498 hospitals across 28 European countries. The data included all adult patients having either elective or non-elective inpatient surgery. Patients undergoing day case, cardiac, and notably obstetrics were excluded under the rationale that they generally have separate care pathways. There was an interesting variation in ethics requirements for the 46,000 or so patients recruited. In Finland, they had to apparently have written informed consent, whereas just down the road in Denmark, nothing was required, so the study was deemed a clinical audit, which is slightly strange. It's not quite in my definition of an audit, but that was the decision nonetheless. Data was also collected on any one patient's first admission to critical care, and whether that was immediately after surgery or at any time during the follow-up period. This formed part of the secondary outcome measure, with the duration of stay, the primary outcome measure being in-hospital mortality. So to the results. The first thing to mention, as always with any data analysis of this nature, is the stats. They are pretty complicated, but very well presented. It's worth pointing out that the investigators have chosen to present their data in terms of odds ratios rather than the more intuitive and related relative risk. I think, and I stress this is only what I think rather than know, that they've used odds because of the linear modelling, large comparisons and generally small differences between the groups. I did quite a lot of Googling and I didn't get very far, but I did find a good free article from the BMJ on the subject of relative risk versus odds ratio, which we'll link to and I think is very useful for anyone who, like me, is slightly confused about the difference. However, as I said, the stats were well presented. So to the headlines. Overall in-hospital mortality was a slightly gobsmacking 4%, which was double the expected figure. Running down the first table in the paper, the baseline data is broken up and odds are given comparing different variables. On the unsurprising side, things that were bad for you included being a bloke, having a higher ASA status and emergency surgery. Upper GI and vascular surgery increased your risk of dying, whilst if you were deemed suitable for a laparoscopic procedure, that was a good prognostic indicator for your mortality, bad for the anaesthetist getting home on time. Being operated on with a cirrhotic liver, congestive heart failure or metastatic cancer all increased your probability of being dead in 60 days, although surprisingly diabetes, and they specify it as not taking insulin, so presumably type 2, didn't appear to increase your chance of dying. What was even more surprising from that table, and I'm not sure if I'm reading this wrong, but being a current smoker seemed to reduce your odds ratio of dying, and not quite, but almost significantly, which I thought was very bizarre and wasn't actually mentioned anywhere else. These variables were used to construct the linear regression models to adjust for baseline difference in populations between countries and then come up with an adjusted odds ratio for mortality data from individual countries compared to the UK. The UK is used as a reference as a quarter of the total dataset comes from the UK and perhaps due to the structure of the NHS we have the most homogeneous healthcare system. I don't know if you guys have read it, but if you had to have an operation, whereabouts in Europe is the safest place to have it done? Sibs, any idea?
I would say somewhere in Scandinavia, Sweden or Denmark.
Okay. Frank?
Yeah, Finland. Finland.
Finland. Finland. Mark, where would you go to have your elective bowel resection?
Lithuania.
Right. So, Mark, unsurprisingly, you're not going to fare so well. And I think, Frank, you said Finland, didn't you?
Yeah.
Which I think came out on top. If you look at the lowest crude mortality, then it's in fact Iceland that comes out with the lowest. But after the linear regression model or sort of physiological fudging, I think looking at the data, you're right, Frank, Finland actually comes out on top. And where do you reckon the danger zones are? Well, unsurprisingly, Mark, Latvia and other less economically well-off countries like Romania fared quite badly. But again, after the adjustment, surprisingly, Ireland and Poland did pretty poorly. I actually found a blog post commenting on the paper on an Irish Anaesthetic Society website. It was a good post pointing out the potential selection bias in the academic centres used for data collection, but did call for a good internal look at the Irish patients to try and work out what the potential causes for the quite striking difference may be. We know from other work that critical care-based interventions do make a difference to outcome in the high-risk surgical patient. As I mentioned, the USOS study was a European Society of Intensive Care-driven initiative and as such collected data on critical care admission. 5% of the patients in the study underwent planned admission to critical care and unsurprisingly you fared much better if you had a planned admission to critical care as opposed to an unplanned one. What was a real surprise was that of the patients who did die, 73% were not admitted to critical care at any time. Further revelations come when you learn that of those who died and were admitted to critical care, nearly half died after they'd been discharged. From this part of the data, the authors write that this suggests a systematic failure in the process of allocation of critical care resources and failure to rescue deteriorating surgical patients. One of the arguments put forward in the discussion highlights the 73% of deceased patients who never hit a critical care bed and makes comparison with cardiac surgery, which has a well-documented 2% mortality in which what is by definition severely diseased population, and they have an almost 100% use of critical care facilities. This is a point that an ICU study sponsored by the European Society of Intensive Care is always going to be keen to make. However, as is pointed out in the accompanying editorial, the data does not always marry up with this. For instance, scanning down the all-important Table 2, with the breakdowns by country, Germany had an 11.6% rate of admission to critical care compared to the UK's 6.3%, and this was accompanied by a non-significant reduction in odds ratio compared to Finland, who had a 4% admission rate, and a larger and almost significant reduction in odds ratio. There is also the differences between countries of what critical care is defined as in terms of resources and level of care. What's quite likely is that appropriate critical care admission is probably one of several factors that improve patient outcome, along with checklists, preoperative assessment, preoperative optimization, and outreach services. I think it's probably this bundle approach which appears to be getting the results in cardiac surgery, and I don't think EUSOS was designed to tease these various components apart. However you look at it, the EUSOS study was a phenomenal piece of work from Rupert Pearce of the Royal London and is the only large prospective dataset looking at non-cardiac surgical outcomes. As such, it's going to serve as an excellent denominator for a raft of future work looking at factors which may improve surgical outcomes, and I'm sure will be one of the most frequently referenced papers in this field over coming years.
Excellent work, both by yourself and by Uncle Rupert.
Yeah, it's from your stable. It follows on quite good from the laparotomy network stuff we were discussing last month, actually. Because it looks like we're just getting a first look at what these numbers are like, and the next stage of the process is starting to look at what we can do to improve things.
I don't think the EUSOS has drawn any firm conclusions about anything, but I don't think it was particularly meant to. I think it was just that, to be this denominator.
Where did the comparative data come from? You said the 8% mortality was much higher. Sorry, the 4% mortality was much higher than expected too. Is that a silly question?
Very good question. No, that's not a silly question at all. So they originally, when they were sort of looking at powering this, let me have a quick look in the paper here. But hang on, I think it's in the beginning of the discussion.
Well, I might have just asked the worst question ever at 9:38 in the evening.
No. This commonly happens, and it's probably going to end up with
it all comes out in the edit.
It'll probably end up on the editing floor, that question.
Oh, hang on, here we go. The key finding was an overall crude mortality of 4%, which is double that expected from national registries. So I think that's probably what it came from. But there's a very good point is that these were a lot of these places were academic centres. So if you look at, they'll be taking on the more difficult caseload. So sure. If you include hospitals which aren't so well equipped and will cherry pick the easy cases, then potentially that figure could come down. But 4% for all general surgical inpatients is pretty high, really.
Yeah.
It is, actually. Yeah, it is.
There was also reasonably high, I thought, unplanned. So if you look at the emergency surgery cases, 14% of those were unplanned admissions to critical care. And that just seems, I mean, for someone who's having emergency surgery, again, I mean, that's what one of the calls were about, what we were discussing last month, is just thinking a bit more carefully about where these patients should be looked after post-operatively or perioperatively, for that matter.
Mm. I think a lot of the sort of thinking behind this was going to be that it was going to prove that critical care does have a big impact on patient outcomes generally. And I'm not entirely sure that this shows that it does.
No, of course. I mean, they were going to set out, this wasn't a case where the turkeys were voting for Christmas. They were setting out to sell themselves as a useful service and it's funded by the European Society of Intensive Care for that purpose, I'm sure. But it's interesting that you point out that the countries where the utility's not as high as you'd expect have reasonable outcomes nevertheless.
Mm.
And the UK would be a point of that if it wasn't the comparative.
Yeah, it wasn't the reference sample.
If it wasn't the reference sample.
Yeah. Anyway, if you want to know more about EUSOS, they've got a website. They've also got a selection of videos. I found a very nice YouTube video of our friend Uncle Rupert, as you said, Sibs, which is definitely worth a look. Anyway, congratulations to all the useless investigators. Thoroughly excellent piece of work.
Can I just point out that Andy Rose from St. George's was one of the investigators, so it's not you, just you boys who got claim to fame.
into London Hospital academic departmental showdown. What was that, thing on MTV I used to love with the clay wrestling?
Oh, yes.
Do you remember what it was called?
Celebrity Deathmatch.
Oh, yeah. It's kind of academic celebrity deathmatch.
Well, I've got to sit through audit tomorrow with Rupert Pearce presenting just this. So I might suggest that to him.
You versus Andy Rhodes.
Him and Andy Rhodes in wrestling outfits.
What does Andy Rhodes look like?
Pass.
Are we still recording this?
Yeah, we are.
This might be a discussion for the third hour of recording.
Yes. Let's move on. So, Mark, you're going to finish the podcast off on a positive note by confirming to us that something we all assume to be cool, from a scientific point of view, is now cool. Or is it?
It is. We're talking, of course, using my typical publication bias. I'm talking about a study that demonstrates, again, that helicopters are good. Some people in France did some science on it, and yep, it is.
Can we all go home now?
Do you want to drill down into the detail in that a little bit, or are we just going to leave us with helicopters are good?
Well, you can probably cut and paste a lot of the analysis, interestingly, from what Sibs was saying about his chronic pain paper, because once again we're dealing with an observational study where what they've done is they've kind of re-looked at data that was collected for a more generic purpose. So this, to go back to the start, this is published in Critical Care September 2012. By the people behind the French Intensive Care Research in Severe Trauma team, or FIRST. So they collected, as part of that, around about 3,000 patients, and collected, sounds to me very similar to our kind of TARN in the UK type data for the nature of people's injuries and their severity scores and predicted survival and so on. So then they've re-looked at some of these patients now to work out, is there any difference in terms of the mode of transport with which they are brought to hospital. And regular listeners will recognise quite a lot of similarities between a paper I talked about back in around April time in JAMA, which again showed that helicopters were good, but didn't really drill down into why or how. And one of the things that we complained about was there's a really wide variation in terms of the medical teams that were staffing the various forms of transport in that previous study. And what caught my interest with this new French one is that the setup they've got is that they have lots of these MICUs, mobile ICU teams, which are either based on ground ambulances, and they tend to be teams put together of a doctor and nurse and specialist driver, usually from the local hospitals, as compared to the helicopter MICUs, which again are an emergency doctor and a nurse and a specialist pilot, but they tend to come from the university hospitals, and the authors would compare their university hospitals to what we would call a major trauma centre. So, out of these 3,200 patients that were collected between December 2004 and March 2007, these were patients, anyone who was above the age of 18 and had suspected severe blunt trauma, severe being defined as requiring admission to the ICU of one of the university hospitals, or people who died before they made it to ICU, who were brought in by the mobile team into the university hospital. They excluded penetrating trauma, they excluded people who died before receiving any treatment, and there's a little bit of a mystery here. There's only 1,958 patients in this study, despite the authors mentioning the 3,200, and it's not totally clear to me where the extra 1,200 went. I think it's they've excluded people who were secondarily transferred, so they've only included people who went straight from the scene of their accident to the major trauma centre. But aside from that, the data is much the kind of thing you'd expect. They found that there was a significantly higher suspicion of severe trauma in the helicopter patients, presumably reflecting their dispatch mechanism kind of working and sending the helicopter to the higher severity jobs. They found a significant increase in the time to get to hospital with the helicopter patients, despite it being a faster mode of transport. And this has been much discussed in the helicopter literature, the fact that we controversially add to scene time, the argument being that these patients are more sick and need more things done before they can be moved. But yeah, that goes on. And again, in this study, the helicopter took longer. Not surprisingly, there were a greater proportion of people with shock or systolic blood pressure less than 90 in the helicopter group, and a greater proportion of people with severe spinal injuries in the helicopter group. So again, probably reflecting a dispatch system which recognises greater severity. All of that said, when they did a bit of maths on it, another multivariate regression logistic thing with several different models, no matter which way they looked at it, they found that the risk of death was significantly lower for the patients transported by helicopter. That was an odds ratio of 0.68, which is quite a noticeable difference. They also found, not surprisingly, an increased risk of death with increasing age or low GCS or blood pressure less than 90 or SATs less than 90. But when adding all of those things into the analysis, still, it would seem that the helicopter made a difference. A bit like the American study we talked about a few months ago, it probably leaves more questions than it answers for me. And the authors themselves point out that some of this difference is quite likely to be the fact that the helicopter medical teams tend to be stuffed with people who are more specialist and more experienced, whereas, as I said, the ground-based teams are coming from the local hospitals. So, once again, we still don't know exactly what it is about these HEMS teams that's making a difference, but still, it's another good positive study and a happy note for us to end on.
Well, thank you very much for that, Mark. I think the piece of work that everyone's desperately trying to do in this area is the thing that says that the helicopter itself is the awesome thing that's making a difference. And exactly as you said, I'm not sure that this piece of work is showing that. And I think it's going to be very difficult because of the nature of the helicopter teams always going to be slightly different from the ground medical team. But also, and right. I was thinking about this the other day, the whereabouts your helicopter is operating is obviously going to be very important. If you're covering a sort of wide rural area, then it's going to make more of a difference than if you're covering an urban area where, in fact, you are often not transporting back in the helicopter.
Yeah. Well, interestingly, they mentioned in this study that when the helicopter gets sent, the patient always is transported by helicopter, which sounded like a very odd phrase, especially the word always, which from my MCQ days always makes me think it must be false. But yeah, certainly the system that you and I are more familiar with here, that's definitely not the case. And I'm not sure if they ever will be able to show that the helicopter alone makes a difference. That's certainly not the way I think we work in the UK. My understanding of the usefulness of the helicopter is less about speed or smoothness or anything like that. It's the fact that to have a team that's so trained and dedicated to dealing with this kind of trauma in the UK, you have to have a helicopter to cover a big enough area to make it worthwhile. I.e., you know, the helicopters we know will do 3 or 4 jobs a day, covering populations of 7 to 10 million people. If you're only covering the radius of a reasonable drive, you're going to need many more of these teams sharing out and diluting the experience they're getting. So that, to me, that's what the helicopter's for. It's meaning you can just cover such a much bigger area with one team.
I was just going to say that it's almost futile trying to show that helicopter alone makes a difference. Is sufficient to show the team that you can assemble and the distance they can cover using that mode of transport is improving outcomes. I think that's more than enough. It's right. Almost an academic pursuit trying to show that a piece of equipment singularly is making the difference.
Quite, yeah. I mean, it may be, as Rick was saying, if you're in a very populated urban area with a very dense population and therefore a dense concentration of trauma cases, and you can cover that population in a car or motorbike or whatever you want, then that would be similar.
You see the other argument is, and they say this right at the beginning of the paper, is that helicopters are expensive. There's also inherently dangerous, but they're mostly very expensive. So if you think it's the skills of the team, which is another point that I actually really liked about this paper, HEMS staff sort of trained to do some fairly invasive things by the side of the road, and as you again said, increase scene time. But it does seem to highlight in this paper that it is in fact those more aggressive interventions that are done by the helicopter's crew that are making a difference. And the argument for the helicopter is, would it be cheaper not to have the helicopter and to employ more highly trained crews that can cover they can only cover a shorter distance, but you have more of them and you have them in a car or something.
But this is my point. There is certainly in this country, there is a finite amount of trauma. So if you put three or four crews in to replace the one crew that we have with a helicopter, they're going to get a quarter of the work. They're going to spend days sitting around not doing anything.
Can I also be controversial in saying you're not going to be able to get motivated, highly trained people into road vehicles? They only want to fly around in the whoop whoops.
I think that's a ridiculous point.
That is outrageous.
Yeah, I'm just putting it out there.
And Ray, give it back to you, fly boys.
Well, thank you very much for that.
You're never ever coming back on our podcast.
Mission accomplished.
It is a proper job. All right.
Sure.
Yes. Yeah. The jumpsuit is proper PPE.
Yeah. It's not just about looking cool.
But you do look cool.
And the aviators stop the glare of the sun.
Okay, so let's move on for a number of reasons, not least because time is once again running away with us. It's time to finish off the podcast with a round of Biology or Bunkum. So Sibs, you are standing in for Rebecca. There's a bit of a leaderboard going on in our second season of Gascast. Well, it's not really a leaderboard, we're just keeping score, which we didn't do last time, to see who is the Biology or Bunkum champion. I believe you're familiar with the way the game works.
I am, but you can feel free to remind me.
Okay, well, so I mean,
options, you say three things and one of them's true.
No, one of them's false.
Okay, one of them's false, okay.
But don't worry. Is Rebecca the worst person at this?
She did pull back a point last time, I think.
In fact, she was the only person who was right last month.
Okay, well, I'll try and fill her boots.
Yeah, I'll try and fill her boots. And we are themed this month, because I don't know if you're aware, but October is Nobel season. And I'm sure you're all very much looking forward to hearing the rest of the Nobel Prize winners as they come out. But this month's Biology Bunkum is an Ig Nobel Prize themed hunt. Are you all familiar with the Ig Nobel Prizes?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Good. Yep. Well, just for anybody who's listening and is not, the Ig Nobel Prizes are an American parody of the Nobel Prize, which are given each year in early October for 10 unusual or trivial achievements in scientific research. However, the stated aim of the prizes is to first make people laugh and then make them think. So it's not like the Darwin Awards and just about people who are being stupid or doing stupid science. It's about people who are doing stupid science to potentially prove quite a clever point. So I've been looking through the Ig Nobel Award winners, and of these three stories, two are genuine Ig Nobel Awards that have been awarded, and one is something that I've invented. And your job is, as usual, to guess which is the invention. So, starting off, here are your three prizes. Number one, the Maths Prize goes to a Canadian group for using complex manifold geometry and fluid dynamics to model the ideal shape of a urinal that creates a zero splashback at typical urinary flow rates. Number two, the Medicine Prize goes to researchers in France for their paper reviewing the literature and investigating the factors that increase the chance of an intracolonic explosion during colonoscopy with electrocautery. And number three, the Neuroscience Prize goes to an American group who have successfully demonstrated that by using complex instruments and simple statistics, you can find meaningful brain activity anywhere, including in a dead salmon. So, those are your three categories and prizes. which one is the figment of my imagination, or the product of my imagination, at least. So, Sibs, do you wanna go first without influence from the others? Or?
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
Okay. I think the clonic explosion is the fib.
Is the fib? Any reason, or is that just a gut feeling you've got? If you'll pardon my hilarious pun.
It was the least plausible of the three, but I can't really. To be honest, they all smelt a bit fishy. The salmon, I thought, was quite true.
Fair enough. Right. So, Mark.
I'm going to agree with Sibs on that, because I heard something about somebody just in the last couple of weeks. I heard something about people doing EEGs on a jelly. And
round trees or from the sea?
No, like a normal jelly, and it wouldn't. I remember them saying that they wouldn't have legally been able to declare the jelly brain dead if it had been an ITU patient in America, based on the EEG, and the theory being that the jelly was picking up kind of radio wave pollution, you know, equipment in the room or whatnot, and it casts some doubt over the whole validity of using any kind of EEG for brain stem death testing. So that one I think is true. It's similar enough to what you said. I think the first one is true because you mentioned a type of mask that I'm pretty sure you wouldn't have ever heard of or been able to make up. So the middle one.
So again, your choice is down to the delivery of the information.
Yeah, I like to get inside your head to work out where the bunker is.
Okay, all right. And Frank.
Well, it might be a clean sweep, actually. I think the colonoscopy one is the bunker. Can't remember, does that mean you get extra points if we're all wrong?
So, yeah, if you're all wrong, I get the points. You were concerned about the scoring last time, Mark, but you can see if you do all go for the same one, then I actually have quite good odds of being correct, depending on how I presented the information. So, let's go through them, and we'll start with number three, which is the Neuroscience Prize. That has indeed, people have indeed put a dead salmon in a functional MRI. I'll just read you, there's a nice poster. We'll link to all of these, all of the prizes that were real, because you can download and they're good to look at. This one's actually a poster prize. Mark, I know you like posters at conferences, and this is one you certainly would have enjoyed even more than you do normally. Introduction, with the extreme dimensionality of functional neuroimaging data, comes extreme risk for false positives. It's a bit, with great power comes great responsibility. Across the 130,000 voxels in a typical fMRI volume, the probability of a false positive is almost certain. Correction for multiple comparison should be completed with these data sets, but is often ignored by investigators. To illustrate the magnitude of the problem, we carried out a real experiment that demonstrates the danger of not correcting for chance properly. And the poster goes on, it's absolutely brilliant. Subject, one mature Atlantic salmon participated in the fMRI study. The salmon was approximately 18 inches long, weighed 3.8 pounds, and was not alive at the time of scanning. And they basically go on, and because they've not corrected for multiple comparisons and done so many things, I think if you look up Bonferroni correction on Wikipedia, that'll show you how it's done. But they managed to get a false positive, which they misinterpreted as a signal. First couple of sentences of the discussion. Can we conclude from this data that the salmon is engaging in the perspective-taking task? Certainly not. So, the task administered to the salmon involved completing an open-ended mentalizing task. The salmon was shown a series of photographs depicting human individuals in social situations with a specified emotional valence. The salmon was asked to determine what the emotion of the individual in the photo must have been experiencing.
I wonder if they needed a license for animal research.
I don't know. They don't say that they did.
If you get your test subject from Sainsbury's, you probably can skip a bit of the ethics stuff.
Anyway, so that is digressing here. So that is biology. Now, next for all of you is the mass prize goes to the Canadian group for using complex manifold geometry and fluid dynamics to model the ideal shape for a urinal that creates zero splash pack. That, I'm afraid, is entirely bunkum.
No.
Balls.
Mark, I was getting inside your head because I thought we're going to have to come up with something mathematical, so I actually Googled complex geometry.
I was going to say, you're going to have to tell us now what manifold geometry is, because I thought there's no way you could have made up manifold geometry.
Okay, I'll tell you exactly how I found that. I decided it would need a story with some complex geometry, so I just stuck complex geometry into Google, then complex geometry. The first thing is Wikipedia, and then it says in the study of complex manifolds. So I just rammed it all together and thought it would work for me, which it did.
Congratulations, Rick. That's...
Thank you very much. So that is a product of Wikipedia and
genius imagination.
Yeah. So the exploding fart gas bowl is true.
Yes. I mean, I have been in some splashback situations, but I've not been able to do the complex geometry to work out how that could not occur. So yes,
I thought that would be right there. That's the kind of tongue-in-cheek thing scientists like to do for their Christmas journal, isn't it?
It is, but not this time. I mean, if someone wants to do it, then go ahead, but you might get next year's Ig Nobel. So the Medicine Prize does indeed go to some French people. They've done the meta-analysis of colonic explosions during colonoscopy. This is in fact a little known but quite severe problem. They've got in their paper, which was published in World Journal of Gastroenterology in 2007, they've looked at all the case studies of colonic explosions. There have been 20 colonic gas explosions, 11 during surgery, 5 during APC, which I'm not sure what that is, 4 during polypectomy, most with perforations, and the polypectomy one with sadly with an associated death. And they've got some good advice in their conclusion for anybody who is undergoing or who undertakes, electrocautery in colonoscopy, and that cleansing solutions containing mannitol or other malabsorbed carbohydrates like sorbitol should be avoided in the preparation of the colon, since intracolonic concentrations of hydrogen or methane could be at combustible levels.
Sounds like a robust meta-analysis of 20 case studies.
Certainly is.
Solid stuff.
Solid science, and that's why they've won a prize. So hopefully that's given you all some research ideas for next year.
Reminds me, you can include this or not. It should have been the discovery of the month. Have you ever seen an extraperitoneal hernia repairs where it's like a laparoscopy, but they just dissect through the soft tissues with a plastic bag?
It's almost like they missed the plane.
Yeah, I did that today, and interestingly, by the end of the operation, the guy's scrotum was like a football. But they said, don't worry, that happens all the time.
With all the air.
Mm.
Carbon dioxide.
But yeah, they just gave it a squeeze and said, it's not going anywhere. How many listeners make it this far through the deep, dark recesses of the end of another 2-hour recording?
Probably not many. So that's it for this episode. Congratulations to me, because I'm now ahead in the Biology of Buncombe Stakes. I think that's two to me and one to everybody else. Sibs, thank you very much for joining us on this episode.
It's a pleasure.
We look forward to having you back soon, just as much as we look forward to having Rebecca back in November. So thanks very much for listening, and we'll see you next time.